The Y Curve with Phil Dobby and Roger Hearing.
Weren't we all supposed to be driving electric cars by now?
Wasn't it all going to be silent streets with no petrol fumes and the country well on target for net zero?
Well, it hasn't happened.
So is it down to cost, the range, the lack of charging stations?
Has the government given up now on making us all battery powered?
Or is the new flood of Chinese-made cheap electric cars going to change everything?
Is it still an electric future?
The Y Curve.
Well, obviously, this is a very timely discussion because I am about to become an electric car driver, and I'm quite excited about it.
You are. So you've bought into all this, haven't you?
I've bought into it. I've bought a Volvo.
Good Lord.
Which is a sign of old age, isn't it, really, when you start becoming a Volvo driver. Mm. But I am 60 this year, so I feel like...
Well, I mean, it's only, you know, a little...
It's only a matter of time. It's just a short hop now to death,
or
basically.
A mobility scooter, perhaps, in between.
An electric mobility scooter.
Definitely.
Though. Yeah, I'll be doing my bit for the environment.
Yes.
But, yeah.
Anyway.
But I'm not quite sure whether I'm doing it because... It's the right thing to do, or more likely, actually...
Because it's a tax break.
It's a tax dodge.
Well, there you are, you see. This is interesting, because you've clearly taken on board the fact that there are incentives out there.
Yeah.
Which is good.
And it's a massive incentive. So if you're running a business and you've made a bit of a profit and you don't want to pay corporate tax...
There we are, you see.
Get a car.
Did you know you get tax advice on the Y Curve?
Yeah.
You do?
You just got it now.
Yes.
Please seek...
Free of charge.
Please seek professional. I think we should do some sort of disclaimer before someone sues us because they buy an electric car and find in their circumstance it doesn't actually apply.
We could be responsible.
But, I mean, it does show how much the government is actually trying to influence our behaviour in this way to try and get us to be voted. So that's a good thing in a way.
Well, it is, but on so many other levels they aren't. I mean, my ex says that she can never find a place to charge her car. You know, it goes a certain distance.
Now you tell me this.
Well, I know. This is the problem, yes. Range is a massive problem.
Yeah.
Charging stations are a massive problem. And the cost is still huge. I mean, okay, you get your tax break, but for the rest of us who don't move in your exalted area, it's really a bit of a problem. So we need to find out whether or not we can actually move to the electric future, which we've been told we need to. And we've got someone who can tell us about that. It's Tom Stacey. He's a lecturer in project supply chain and operations management at Anglia Ruskin University and quite an expert on this, and he joins us now.
All right. So, Tom, I mean, we do see a lot more electric cars on the road, obviously, and I'm seeing numbers saying that there are a million of them now on Britain's roads. So, and it is increasing, isn't it? I mean, it's starting to take off. Is it taking off as much as was expected and as much as the government
and
had hoped for?
As fast as was expected.
Yeah.
Really good question. I mean, the government's targets in the next 10 years is for it to be 100% of new cars sold, for it to have to be 100% of new cars sold. And then when you look at 10 years ago, it was less than 1%. So they've got a long way to go. Now, if you know anything about, you know, technology adoption and technology curves, then they do tend to ramp up exponentially, which is good. And I think if we plotted that on the graph right now, we would see we're definitely in the ramp up period. We're in that exponential growth. However, with all of these things, there comes a point where, you know, not everybody wants to get on board with it. You know, these technology curves don't tend to deliver 100%. Necessarily, not everybody always converts, and yet we're having to say that every single car that you purchase and light goods vehicles will have to be electric, and it's an ambitious target. So it is growing. I mean, we were 10 years ago at a point where it was less than 1%. We're now at a point where it's broadly 1 in 5 new cars sold, but we need to continue that rate of growth.
It's interesting, though, that 4 out of 5 are still not, and yet we've got this deadline. I guess at some point people are going to be saying, well, the resale value of this car, well, I'm not quite sure. Does it make it better, in fact? If you've got a petrol car when you can't buy new ones, does that increase the resale value of petrol-powered cars in 5 or 6 years' time?
Classic supply and demand, isn't it? Absolutely. A supply... And when I say absolutely, that things follow that model. Will that happen here? I wish I had the crystal ball because I would go and buy, you know, I would go and buy petrol cars now, hoping that it would be my retirement fund. I think the problem that we're going to have is that, yes, the collectible petrol cars are always going to be collectible. They'll always be worth perhaps more than a mass market product. What you're going to find is that you will struggle to fuel them. You will struggle to find
because there's going to be no petrol stations.
Yeah, because there's no business. There's already very, you know, the business model for filling stations isn't great. And I say that coming from, you know, I was brought up and my parents had a garage and had a filling station, and I watched firsthand through how the scene, and not I was a kid, but from what they said to me, you know, in the 70s, it was good. In the 80s, they used to have to sell more chocolate bars. In the 90s, it became very difficult to be competitive, to make any money. And then when the onslaught of supermarkets getting into the petrol station market, who could rely on volumes of people leaving their supermarkets and also didn't have to make the profit margins because they were making the money on the fuel. They cleaned up that market and then they pushed people out. And then what you've seen since the 1990s is a decline in the number of filling stations. Any new filling stations that are built now really are there to replace another one, you know, where they've moved a service station down the road or something like that, or they've redeveloped a site. People aren't building them. And that trend will undoubtedly continue. And then you'll end up in a situation like the dawn of the internal combustion engine car, where you used to have to go to the chemist, you know, you used to have to go to a specialist and buy petrol in pint bottles.
It's a reverse, Tom, of the problem which we know is there, which is at the moment you can't find reliably places to charge your electric car. So we've got to get to a point where there are more of those than there are filling stations.
And that is a real worry, isn't it? Because I'm very excited, by the way, because I'm just about to get one next week. I'm getting
seven times on this podcast so far about Phil's new car, but it will increase.
A Volvo EC40.
Yes, we know the make. Yes, whatever.
But it's I'm not getting paid for this, by the way. But I'm very excited about Bill Rogers almost saying I will almost certainly be left high and dry at some point.
Because you won't be able to get the charging. I mean, charging's a massive problem, isn't it?
I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that, having lived this lifestyle. So, you know, full disclosure here, I've had an electric car for over 10 years now, in one form or another. Yes, 10 years ago, I had some really squeaky backside moments. You know, I had a car with short range. The chargers were slow. They weren't very frequent at all, and they often didn't work. And it was a real sacrifice to kind of follow this, you know, this want to be more sustainable in transportation, of owning an electric car. It was difficult then. The revelation, or the revelation, happened for me around 2017, where public charging was still not great, but I bought a Tesla. So I will say the brand of car that I bought. It was an extremely expensive purchase for me, being a car guy as well. It was a lot of thinking. All of a sudden, overnight, it was going from my previous electric vehicle, which was then my second, which was tricky to charge. I mean, I was lucky. I charged it at home. I had charging at work. Most of my commute, 95% of what I did was actually fine. I just needed to think about it. And in a lot of ways, it was more convenient. However, when I went on those long runs, it was panic mode.
But you feel like that's gone away now, do you?
I think buying the Tesla, made it back then 7 years ago, made a huge difference. Then all of a sudden there was a car that had a charging infrastructure that was strategically placed. The chargers were numerous, reliable, and very fast. And the car knew about them. The car knew how much charge it had. The car knew the rate it was, and still does, discharging, knew where you were going, took you to the chargers. It wasn't really a massive detour. It was a quick stop. I probably needed a comfort break or a coffee by then anyway. That approach of connecting, it's a bit like Apple with the software and hardware of their products, of connecting the vehicle with the thing that it has to go hand in hand in, which is the charging, with the software that ran both the charging and the vehicle fleet together, was a revelation.
It's interesting that you make that analogy with Apple, because one of the complaints, and I remember reporting on this, was that the charging points were exclusive, in exactly the same way that a lot of Apple stuff only works with Apple products.
But I don't think that's the case now.
But that's been changed, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's been changed. And I think the second part of that really was a masterstroke. And I mean, to be honest, within the Tesla community, that was divisive. People didn't want their golden egg to be taken away from them, didn't want to lose that exclusivity, especially as Tesla owners thought at the time they'd helped pay for that charging infrastructure, and they were continuing to. And by putting in an ability for anybody to use it, they thought, well, hang on a minute, you know,
Volvo drivers.
Yeah, Volvo drivers.
No, not Volvo drivers. They get excluded.
you know, that's changed everything. So really what you've got with you know, Tesla are still building out their charging infrastructure, as are others, and we'll come to that hopefully in a minute. Tesla are building out their charging infrastructure. When they build it out, they take it seriously. They put a lot of chargers in. They're all super, super reliable. They're all super fast. They're in reasonably good locations. And now they're open to others, and they're simple to use for others as well, which is another point that's worth making. They are helping the transition to electrification of vehicles for everybody. And I think one of the, you know, two of the criticisms that I have personally of the EV charging infrastructure in the UK and also in Europe as well, probably worldwide to be fair, is that one, it's a disparate system. It's not connected. The government has tried to kind of enforce some commonality. You know, they've got certain ones have got to take contactless bank cards, and they've got to be open to all, which has helped, but it doesn't help that they're all on different networks. They won't exclusively have to take a contactless card. Many of them, you'll still need a membership. So you'll either need an RFID card, or you'll need an app, or you'll need a website. It's never the same.
And surely we need the same thing that you got with Tesla across all cars, where you can be told, well, okay, this is the nearest station, and by the way, there's a space available, and you're going to get there before you run out of charge. I mean, we need that sort of integration across all makes of cars.
We do, and it's called plug and go, and it's a great idea, but it's not enforced. You know, not every manufacturer and charge point manufacturer signs up to it. It's a voluntary code, as far as I know, and no one around the world, in terms of government, in terms of policy, is enforcing that. So you're ending up with a situation where there isn't that interoperability. Third party apps help, and third party software like ZapMap and others and Octopus help, but you know, it only. Then the onus is on the third party to go out and make sure that those chargers are working, make sure that they've got the correct pricing information and the correct availability. And it's far from complete. So, you know, outside of the world, and going back to Tesla for a minute, they've realized that their supercharger model is so good that they are now selling their chargers, the Tesla superchargers, to other third parties to install using the Tesla back end. And the first one opened this week. But, you know, you get into a question of, should it be monopolistic? Because we've go back to Apple. Apple have been in a lot of trouble recently with the EU, with America, with the American government at the moment, for having that monopolistic model that clearly works very well for consumers. They know what they're getting. They know it's going to work. It's simple, but they have control of it.
So is there money in running these charging stations? I mean, Tesla, I mean, I would have thought when they started, they were there as a support mechanism to try and sell cars. But for these other players that are involved, I mean, is there a danger it's going to be a bit like the service stations that you're talking about? There's just not a great deal of money, in which if there's not a lot of money to be made from it, we're not going to see the investment. Because I'm looking at some figures here, the International Energy Agency, the number of electric cars per charger, obviously the lower the better by various countries. So there are 55 cars per charger in New Zealand. There's two in South Korea, so no problem getting your car charged up there. The UK is about 20, which is about the same as Australia. Germany, interestingly, considering they make lots of cars, you'd assume increasing number of those is going to be electric. They're on 25.8. So it's a huge variation. I'm wondering what's driving that variation. Is it the cost efficiency? Is it the profit incentive varies by country, or is it government policy? What's the dynamic there?
I can only speak for the UK, really, where I have some kind of intimate knowledge of what's going on. And the biggest thing that's been holding back charge point rollout is actually around getting the land, and these all sorts of weird bylaws about running cables under land to get the power to them. It's about the land, and then it's connection by the DNO, by the grid, essentially, to the chargers. You know, they are not an insignificant thing to wire in. You know, if you're getting an extension built on your house and you need a bit more power put in, you know, you need to upgrade the fuse box or whatever, it's a simple thing, because you're not going to pull a lot of power. You know, a few peak load of maybe 20 kilowatts. When you put in 10 250 kilowatt chargers, you know, you do the math, you're talking about significant amounts of power. So it's a significant undertaking for the DNOs to get them in. It's a significant amount of cabling and infrastructure work that needs to be done.
So from everything you're saying in this, what you're saying is that we are moving pretty rapidly to a point, and yes, there are lots of teething troubles and things that need to be got over, exactly what you're talking about there, that perhaps need a government push, a change in regulation, something. But we're certainly within easy reach now of a situation where there will not be problems in terms of charging in the right across the country. You'll be able to charge your car, and the range you'll have as a result will mean that it will be effectively like having a petrol car.
Or does the government need to step in and remove some of these roadblocks in terms of getting power to these locations? Because remember, Rishi Sunak is very good at trying to push to get power put into power stations, local power stations, because he got a swimming pool in Richmond. So he knows, he's shown it can be done. So do we need to get the government to be more proactive in this? Is that part of the problem?
We need to keep putting pressure on. They are starting to take notice of these issues because of the... You know, it's been publicly reported in the press. There's a bunch of electric car rapid chargers installed in car parks around the country with covers on them that aren't on. And people ask why. And it's reported that it's getting connection to the grid that's the issue. So I think that's becoming more and more of an issue.
That's the fundamental issue.
Yeah,
really.
So I think we need to keep the pressure up. You know, going back to your point about are we on the right track? You know, I'm optimistic, actually. And this is... You know, this is a simpler problem to fix than if we were trying to bring in something like hydrogen or if we were trying to do the rollout of the internal combustion engine car now. I mean, it's not insignificant to create oil refineries, the supply chain, the infrastructure, filling stations, all this. You know, you're talking about a highly, you know, hundreds of litres, thousands of litres of highly flammable liquid that need to be moved around, training, all that kind of stuff. If you were to try and build an explosive gas or liquid fuel infrastructure now, it would prove very difficult and very costly. The good thing about electricity is, look, we're already cabled up for electricity. You know, you can charge your car so many places where there's already electricity. It would mean that if you were really in the middle of nowhere and you're plugging into someone's plug socket, you know, 13-amp plug socket, your car's going to charge very slowly. So you need to think about not turning up and expecting the thing to be charged in an hour if you're plugging into a very low power supply. It's going to take a day. But if you can stay over there, it's fine. Or if you're in an emergency and you need to plug in and you can do something else with your time, fine. We have got electricity everywhere. We do have enough capacity within the grid to move to electrification. The National Grid have written about that at length, and you can go and have a look at the white paper.
So there's enough power out there, basically.
Because that's often, I mean, that's an argument that's often used, isn't it? That there's just, if everyone was on an electric vehicle, we just would not have enough power in the grid. You say that's just baloney.
Well, there's two, you know, people confuse two issues here, and one is the capacity for generation, and the other is the capacity for transmission. And when it comes to the capacity for generation, there are times when we produce too much electricity in this country because of renewables, when the wind's really blowing, we're producing too much electricity. And that's exemplified by the fact that certain energy providers will now pay you to take the energy from the grid because they've got too much of it. And what do you do with it? You can't make it disappear. You've got to consume it. So if you pay people, they'll stick everything on. So we have got enough capacity to generate at times, not all of the time. So this concept of potentially there being brownouts. And I saw Dale Vince was talking about this. Dale Vince, the head of Ecotricity, was talking about this just yesterday. There's lots of scaremongering about brownouts, but there's plenty of
a brownout is when the power level is so low that the lights, everything just looks slightly brown. I've been in a few of those in Africa where the power amount is not enough for the capacity for what you
exactly
require.
The voltage drops too low and everything isn't running at full speed. So we have got enough. And in terms of transmission, again, people will say, well, the connections, the grid connections are old, they're under capacity in certain areas. That's only a problem if everybody comes home at the same time and all plugs their electric cars in at the same time, and they're drawing a lot, you know, and it's the middle of winter and they're drawing a lot in their houses. So the answer to that, and the answer for at least 10 years from the National Grid, is we need to be smarter about how we do it. We don't need to build more power stations. We do need to build more renewable. Absolutely we do, because burning fossil fuels to create electricity just moves the problem along. Okay, if you you know it, it's
we just need, the whole we need point to be smarter about isn't capacity, is what you're saying, I think, isn't it? And so, I mean, so I found so. By the way, my next door neighbour, who's got electric grids on his roof, he's got that, so he's getting paid for that, putting some of that back into the
solar
into
panels. The, we normally
solar
call.
Panels, that's what it is. But he's also sometimes, he gets paid to take power out of the out system. Of the grid as well.
Well, perhaps you can get him to fuel your car. That's the
well,
next
I was
stage.
Thinking you would just run a wire over it. But the but the interesting thing as well is because I'm with Octopus Energy. May as well give them a plug as well.
Everything's
just,
getting a name.
The advertising's going to start rolling into this podcast sometime soon. And they obviously they give me a lower rate if I charge overnight, but also if I charge during the day. They know because my charger is logged into my account. They know when I'm charging my vehicle, and they can say, "Well, okay, if it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon, we've got a bit of spare capacity. Mm-hmm. We'll let you have the charge at whatever it is, 7 or 9 pence per kilowatt hour." As opposed to the 30 pence or whatever it is that I'm currently paying. So that's all very smart stuff, isn't it? Using whatever's available at the time to help you charge your car, irrespective of the time of day.
Yeah, and let's remember, and I'm writing a piece on this at the moment, and I've been looking at the research, that broadly the headline is, you know, 95% of the time, 95% of cars are going nowhere. So they're plugged in. And so, in theory, they could be plugged in. They're not moving. So what you really need to do is it goes back to our original point, build out this charging infrastructure, build it anywhere you can. I guarantee you, you know, most people who work in an office, in most employers, they've got electricity. They've got electricity in the car parks. If they've got car parks, the light, the thing, there's electricity there. Put the charge points in, encourage people to plug the cars in. And then using that smart technology, and all of these electric cars all have an app, they all have an API, they're all able to communicate with the internet in some form or another. When there is an excess of electricity, charge them. And perhaps if you can integrate two-way charging, which is a very, very new concept, and there's very few cars with two-way charging, but they are coming. If you've got a car full of battery and you can say on your app, look, it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm not going home till five. I'm only going 20 miles. I don't need it. Instead of charging me up, why don't you take a bit of my battery charge? Why don't you take a bit of my battery
to run the washing machine?
Run wherever to help the grid. And then with that, pay me. Yeah.
So what about the price of cars?
Yeah, because I was going to say we've done the power in a issue, which is clearly a big one. But if I'm honest, the reason I'm not buying electric cars, I'm not half as rich as Phil here. And
well, he's just not as skilled or professional.
No, well, absolutely, loads of issues on that front. But the main thing is its price. I mean, the price is still too much. Even the second-hand electric car market. It's very elevated. So, I mean, that is going to be the major issue to get over, isn't it, Tom?
We're going to get to 2035 where you've got no choice. Either get a second-hand petrol car with a dwindling number of petrol stations, or, you've got to somehow shell out for a car that you can't afford.
So what can be done about the price issue?
Well, and let's not forget, when you get to 2035, the point we made earlier is if there aren't very many petrol cars around and some of them are collectible or interesting to certain people, the prices of those are going to be elevated. So they won't be cheap and they won't be making very many of them. So
we're just going to get loads of people outpriced from driving then.
Supply and demand. I mean, there's positive news around the pricing of cars. Like I say, when I bought my first EV, it was overpriced for what it was, but the charging was all free then. The charging was free, the road tax was free. Even the insurance companies didn't really understand them, so the insurance wasn't particularly expensive because the only risk profile they had was that people were driving them very slowly to get more range. So it was a cheap car to run, even though it was expensive to buy. When I bought the Tesla, a lot of money. Really, when I look back, a lot of money. Again, free charging, but it doesn't pay for it. So where are we now? All new cars are expensive. I've spoken at length in other podcasts and in interviews. All cars are expensive. All cars are getting more expensive. If you want to go and buy a petrol 3 Series BMW, or you want to buy, let's say, a Tesla Model 3 or a Polestar 2 or something like that, they've got price parity. They're all expensive. They're all heavy. So let's part that. But the cheapest cars in the market are petrol. They are small, they are simple, they're petrol. And there's a lot of reasons for that, mainly due to economies of scale and having things at different price points, in some cars making more profit than others. What there aren't is a lot of cheap electric cars. However, the manufacturers realize that has to change. They're fully aware of the arguments that you guys have just spoken about. So we're looking at Dacia and the Spring, which is about £14,000, £15,000 for a brand new EV. It's not a great EV necessarily. I shouldn't say that. It's not, you know, it's not at the top of features and luxury, but it is an electric vehicle. It doesn't have a very good range, but it has enough for most people. Most
well, I mean, what you need. I mean, you know, when you say it's not fit, I mean, it's good. I mean, given if you say, well, it can't go backwards, you know, that might be
a
bit limiting. But, you know, generally, I mean,
it'll get you down the shops and back.
We're just the same as a cheap petrol car. Yeah, so you think the prices will come down, and then with that, presumably, obviously, secondhand. Because where was going to be the big concern? Are we going to reach a point where, you know, everyone's getting new cars, and people who normally lived on buying fairly old secondhand cars suddenly find that they can't afford? You know, they're priced out of the market.
Will there be a secondhand market in the electric cars? The people who've had last year's model will want next one.
But will it be as cheap? That's the question.
That's a really interesting question, and we could go for a very deep dive, which I don't think we should, in terms of, you know, the reliability of electric cars versus internal combustion engine cars as they get older.
Are they as reliable?
They are more reliable. MOT data would tell you that they're more reliable. However, some components are more expensive to replace. You know, if your battery pack goes, there is not the secondhand refurbished market for batteries. That again is nascent and developing, because there's no demand for it. The battery packs generally, like, you know, they're all warranted for at least 8 years in all EVs that I'm aware of, and even at 8 years, it doesn't mean they suddenly go wrong. They just lose capacity, and some of them may go wrong, but it won't be the whole pack that normally goes wrong. In my experience, it's one or two modules.
And are they really good for the environment? Obviously, it depends on where you're getting the energy from, how that energy is created. But there's also a lot of coverage lately about the fact that electric cars are so heavy that they are damaging our roads, and also the wear and tear from the tyres is more polluting than lighter petrol cars. So where do we go with that? Can we fix that problem?
I mean, I'm going to hold my hands up. My Tesla Model S is heavier on tyres than a small petrol car. It's a big car. It's heavier on tyres. I couldn't argue.
And it's heavier because the battery is heavier. Essentially, that's what we're talking about.
It's a big car with a big heavy battery, with a lot of tech on board. Tech and safety is what's making cars heavier. When you put a battery pack in, the battery pack as a single component of the car is heavy, but you're removing exhaust systems, you're removing transmissions, you're removing engines, you're removing all the emissions control equipment, auxiliary power steering, all that kind of stuff gets removed as well. So it's not like you're adding all that on there. The really heavy ones are a lot of the big plug-in hybrids, like the SUVs. A lot of the SUVs now, in order to make them a bit cheaper on company car tax, are extremely heavy, but that's because they've got everything in them. Going back to the point about, are they bad for the environment? They're always going to have the law of entropy on their side. This is the thing. This is the thing with electric cars. With internal combustion engine car, once you burn that fuel, it's gone. All it's turned into is heat, noise, and warmth, and a whole bunch of particulates and CO2 that you don't really want in the environment if you can avoid it. So with an electric car, you charge that battery up, it discharges at a fairly even rate. You know, the power you put in is the power you get out. It's not the same.
But it's the particulates from the tyres that people are talking about at the moment. So, I mean, will we see tyre technology?
Can improve, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to say, will we see the tyre technology improve in the same way that we're seeing vehicle technology?
Yeah, they already are. You've got a trade-off there. You can make a very hard tyre that wears very slowly, but it doesn't have as much grip, and it isn't as safe. And then the tyre manufacturers, and I was working closely with Michelin through something else that I was doing last few weeks, the trade-offs they have to do, the development they have to do is incredible. Technology is helping them. Technology is meaning that actually they have more grip and better wear characteristics than they did in the 1960s, purely because of the way that they're made, understanding how they wear. Simple things as well, like, go and get the geometry checked on your car, you know, get a four-wheel alignment on it. You would not believe how much that can wear the tires unevenly. It's not like an even wear that causes a lot of tires to be thrown away prematurely. It's an uneven wear that wears one part of the tire, and then you're throwing away good unworn tire.
So the technology is going to catch up, essentially,
yes,
whether it's tyres or building better roads, possibly, I suppose, might be another thing. But we can get
that's
there.
That's going to be the last thing to do.
Well, maybe. But what about the fact that, which has a lot been talked about, and vast numbers of Chinese-made, relatively cheap, potentially, I suppose, transmitting our data cars that are going to come onto the market pretty soon. We know that the Americans are already wary about this. Is that going to be a big factor?
Because China's BYD, now bigger than Tesla. So 1.8 million cars last year versus 1.3 million Teslas. My Volvo is made in China. They are making loads of cars.
Yeah, and the thing that's surprised me over the last couple of years, going to trade shows, going to exhibitions, and reading, you know, reading in the news, is how hard the Chinese are pushing into Western markets, how aggressive they are, and how visible they are, and actually how good the product is. The product is really, really good. The Chinese made Volvos and the Polestars, which are kind of Volvo design, a Geely design, built in a Chinese factory, a factory that was created just to build that product. They are excellent. I mean, they're really, really well made. They're really high quality. You wouldn't be able to detect that you weren't in a European car. Absolutely not. They're a really high quality product. The Chinese have a stranglehold on the manufacture and supply of lithium ion batteries, so much so that I think we probably need to be a little bit worried about this. How much they've tied up the supply chain, how much they've tied up the manufacture. There's a lot of lithium in the world, and the lithium is reusable as well, which is a really interesting point. Going back to EVs versus petrol cars, where you burn the fuel and it's gone. You know, the energy's gone to somewhere else in the system where we don't want it in the planet, in the atmosphere of the planet. With lithium-ion batteries, you can take them apart. It's not trivial, but you can take them apart, you can recycle them, you can get the lithium out of them.
I think it's more the problem that the actual process of mining lithium is pretty unpleasant for the environment, but that's a side issue.
And it's also, I mean, obviously it determines the geography of you know, the new power breaking is less to do with oil, more to do with the mineral resources for batteries, whether it's lithium or cobalt or manganese or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that can come from anywhere. It's just the size of the country that is the
depends where,
effect,
where the stuff is, of course. Yeah.
Well, Australia and China have an advantage here because they're large land masses and they have a lot of natural resources. If you look at, I've been looking quite closely at the economy and the lithium economy of South America recently, and South America is sitting on 65% of the world's lithium, and they've also got a lot of other natural resources, a lot of manganese and gold and all the things that we need. But it's split amongst a lot of different countries. And I think if you go to the south of South America, if you go to Peru and Argentina, a lot of that lithium is contained within massive salt flats. So it's actually quite easy to get to. And it's not particularly destructive to the environment to get it. It's probably better than copper mining, to be honest, which really does strip the landscape. But if you go to the northern part of South America, if you go to go to the mid and the north, you go to Brazil, Venezuela, Guyana, Colombia, that this part of the world, it's under forest. So the problem we have, we're going to have another kind of ecocide scenario where the value of those natural resources to the governments are incredibly high, but they're going to, you know, they're potentially going to cut down the forests to get to it, or they're going to destroy the lakes and the rivers. And that is a worry. But I mean, you know, look at Venezuela and what happened with the oil industry. It's not, if you look at the alternative, it's not exactly lovely what happened there. You know, the destruction of a nation, really, because
we choose our version of ecocide, essentially.
Yeah.
Because not squeaky clean, we were saying there are consequences. Yeah. And I guess, I mean, is it something that we can do? Can we reduce the amount of resources that are needed?
If lithium keeps going, we don't actually need to replace it. Presumably we don't need to absolutely exhaust the earth of it.
We recycle it. And that is the wonderful thing about lithium ion batteries. It's not, as I said earlier, it's not trivial to recycle them, but it's absolutely possible. And you don't need to dig up new. You'd always need to dig up some new. But if you look at, if we move to a completely sustainable energy economy, we would mine significantly less than we do now, because we need significant less, because the assumption there is that you recycle quite a lot of it, and there's a lot wasted. There's a lot of cobalt that's dug out of the ground and refined to use in the manufacture of low sulfur petrol and diesel. So one of the largest users of cobalt is not in lithium-ion batteries, but actually to desulfurize fuel. So if you remove that, then you remove all the cobalt that's needed for that. So
that's another gain.
It goes back to what I said earlier, which is about entropy. Electric cars have that on their side. You're always going to use less if you can use something like that as a closed cycle.
Do you think there's a future for the car manufacturing industry in the UK on this, or are most parts of the world going to lose out to places like China because of that natural mineral advantage, and they can just, you know, integrate vertically, whereas we don't have that ability? We're at a cost disadvantage, first of all, in having to import the raw materials, plus obviously a higher cost of labour.
Mm-hmm. And that's another really complicated one and a really interesting one. I'd love to have a crystal ball. You know, I'm a big supporter of the UK car industry. I think we can design really innovative vehicles. We have probably some of the leading engineers in the world for vehicle dynamics. You would be amazed how many vehicles are tuned by the British, the likes of Lotus and other engineering companies who are designing the vehicle dynamics for all sorts of manufacturers and always have done. We're really good at design. We're not too bad at manufacture. We were terrible at manufacture in the 1970s and lost our advantage, but we've got better at it. So the ingredients for the UK car industry are there to be great. And we do, you know, we have some great manufacturers. We have Jaguar Land Rover creating great products, creating EVs, Aston Martin. We've got electric Rolls Royces. There's, albeit they're owned by the Germans, and they get advantage of their supply chain. However, we are good at it. The problem that we've got is, let's come back to the B word, after Brexit, it's and I've studied this at length and commented on this at length. It's harder to build cars in the UK because of Brexit, and that was warned about, and it remains harder.
Along with so much else, of course.
We still do make quite a few, though, don't we? And most of it is still exported to Europe. But it's whether we can pick up, and it has gone down a bit over the last couple of years. I guess it's a bad time to be a petrol head, isn't it? But there again, if you are a petrol head, you can always buy, you know, your cars are going to be more collectible, and you're going to be buying your fuel on the black market.
There'll be plenty of people doing that, I think.
But if you're a petrol head and you haven't driven an electric car, when you put your foot on the accelerator, you're going to be impressed, aren't you? I mean, they pick up fast.
I love both. I always have done. I come from a background in automotive ever since I was a tiny little child, and I love both. They have different characters. For me, seeing the damage that internal combustion does to the local environment and to the wider climate was the turnoff for me. If they could recreate that feel and that sound and that noise. I know Hyundai are trying to do that with some of their electric vehicles. You know, they make a noise and they feel like a petrol car, and they feel like I've got a gearbox, which completely possible to do if people want that. Then great. Actually, the only research I could find about this when I was looking into this last year is if you give London cabbies an electric cab and you give them a diesel cab, the ones that drive the electric cab drive better, they're more refreshed, they feel happier, and the passengers are happier. I think people prefer to drive EVs.
You want to keep London cabbies happy, definitely, as a big part
you
of this.
Say,
so
possible?
We're going to have to, I think, curtail this, but thank you so much for giving us a sense of where it's all going. You and Phil, clearly, on one particular side of the fence, I'm still excited.
Well, you know the car I'm talking about, the EC40 from Volvo. It's a nice car, isn't it?
You don't have to sell it, you know. You've already bought one. Anyway, Tom's a Tesla man, so we'll divide that between you. Tom, thank you so much for
good
being with us.
Tom.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, well, there we are. I tell you, I'm very excited. Just in case you haven't noticed.
You should see him. It's a shame you can't. He is.
Well, do you know, it's mainly actually having a new car. I haven't had a new, brand new car for, I don't know, 30 years or something like that. I've always been getting secondhand cheap cars. So I'm looking forward to this. But anyway, look, next week we're back to talking about politics, really, aren't we?
We are, because the local election's coming up. We're going to see interesting situations here, I think, in terms of how Reform do, because as a party, they're certainly getting quite high in the polls.
Yeah, there is a real risk, isn't there? By the time we get around to a general election, they might actually get more votes than the Tory party.
Well, it's feasible. And what this gets us into the whole idea of is populism. I mean, they are a populist party. They're not a traditional right-wing party. And these parties like them have grown up all over Europe, Portugal recently, the Netherlands, lots of places. They're getting real electoral advantage. And of course, you could say Trumpism in the States is of a similar issue.
And what it means is politicians, irrespective of their persuasion, are having to respond to the human populistic tone for whatever it might be, whatever the subject is, people are having to find a response to it rather than the...
It isn't the classic left-right thing of the old days.
It isn't.
It's very different.
Yeah.
And we want to find out what it means, what its significance is, how it's going to change our politics.
Yeah.
And that's all coming up.
For better or worse.
Yes.
I can't actually see any good coming out of it, but maybe we'll try and
see. We're terrible old liberal leftists.
Exactly.
So what do we know?
Exactly.
But we'll find someone who does.
Yeah.
That's all coming up on the next edition of...
The Why Curve. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening today.
Bye.
The Why Curve.